I'm Joseph.
And I'm Nick.
And this is Fish Jelly.
Mm-hmm.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. Did you see Lizzo posted on Instagram that I quit?
No. Like her job? Her profession?
Her profession?
The flute?
Oh.
What did you quit, girl? Eating?
Oh,
ooh,
damn.
I know. That was bad. That was mean. But what did you quit?
So a day after headlining a Democratic National Committee fundraiser, she posted on Instagram. This is just like pieces from the post. I'm getting tired of putting up with being dragged by everyone in my life and on the internet. All I want is to make music and make people happy and help the world be a little better than how I found it. Being the butt of the joke every single time because of how I look, my character being picked apart by people who don't know me and disrespecting my name. I didn't sign up for this shit. I quit. And of course, I'm sure this is all related to all those accusations.
That she's mean.
Sexual harassment and discrimination and that she's mean. You know, all that shit blew up last year and then it kind of like died out. Some of the people making the allegations, like some of that, I understand that some of those people like dropped their charges and there are still some that are pending and.
I think she probably made some people mad, but I don't know. Like, I think you just have to tune out all that shit though on the internet and keep like, you can still make music. I don't know. What's the point of paying attention to all the haters? Like, I'm sure that there have been haters her whole life being a bigger woman. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. My initial thought is, you know, you just have to keep doing what you're doing. Like if you really love making music, then you just have to keep going. And I don't know that I would fully log off.
Yeah. You just,
I would fully log off and concentrate on my shit.
Yep. Cause in the end, none of that shit, all those people screaming in the void that doesn't really matter. It shouldn't have that kind of an impact on you. So that's sad that she's feeling that way. I was thinking that you were going to say the story was along the lines of like Keke Palmer, who's like, I think I'm going to be retiring soon. It's like, girl, how old are you?
Yeah. No, it seems like she's probably at like a breaking point and hopefully someone close to her who she trusts might get her to sit down somewhere and reevaluate some things. Cause this feels like partial, like a half-assed cry for help.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is it allows people to see that they got to you. And again, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, nothing wrong being vulnerable.
But I think that's just unfortunate, being like, they got to you. Like when I want to hear from someone like her is like, fuck y'all.
Well, or I would want to hear like, you know, I think like early on in my career, I didn't quite know how to handle, because here's the other thing. Like she is a business person, right? She had staff. There are certain ways to conduct yourself, not unlike if you work a corporate job and you manage people. Like there are certain things I can't say and do, or people will consider me inappropriate and file grievances with HR. So I think maybe for someone in her situation, she probably needed to and still needs to come out and, you know, take some responsibility for her behavior, because all these allegations have very specific examples of things that she did and said.
Did she ever address those?
I don't know.
I haven't followed that closely.
No, I haven't either. But I think that's all you can do is just admit, like, honestly, I had no experience basically managing people. Mm-hmm. And then my career blew up and I'm trying to be a creative artist and balancing that line between creativity and being appropriate in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Are two different, you know, like that's complex. And people saying that she's mean, and it's like, well, maybe you need to address that too. Like, I haven't always been the nicest person, and make your excuses and people will relate to them and move on. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't work in PR. Seems like she's had a difficult time bouncing back. It's also been not very long.
Mm-hmm.
She's clearly very talented. So I think if she just chills,
I think, yeah, if you just, you know, take a little self rest.
Yeah.
And then get back to it and keep creating behind the scenes and ignoring all that bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, I hope she has enough money that she can pay her for her housing and her Postmates. And I hope that, like, yeah, she continues to create. And maybe when the iron is hot, she'll have, you know, projects and things that are ready to go, right? Songs that are ready to drop. But Yeah. My overall thought is I feel bad for her that she needs to probably like take a step back and log off.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. We don't have to be constantly logged into social media at all hours. Like it, you get so much more done if you aren't looking at your phone.
But even like if you have a job where your coworkers make you feel away and talk shit about you behind your back, I've had that. And I just thought,
same.
Like,
yeah.
I don't. Did it bother me? Yes. Would I come home and talk about it? Yeah. Like it did affect me, but I also thought like, I'm not going to let these people.
Those people are.
There's a little bit of money I get paid at this damn company. And like, and then to make it worse, I'm going to go in and let these people.
Well, no. those aren't the people paying your bills. So
in fact, once I realized what was happening, I took a lot of pleasure in like rubbing shit in their faces. Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't like me? I'm going to give you a reason not to like me. Mm-hmm. So I started pulling all kinds of stunts and getting close with the manager. So I was like leaving early and taking days off without putting in PTO. I was in all kinds of bullshit because I thought, well, I'm going to make you really not like me. And luckily it worked out in the end. But
oh, people get so bothered if they see you not seeming bothered by the same bullshit. Like that. Because, I mean, I've always been one in the jobs I've had to avoid fraternizing because I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to, like, most of the time I don't want to be there. So I'm just trying to get through the day in the best way that I can, compartmentalizing, and leave. And people don't like that. People don't like if you don't go to lunch with them and talk about all their little inane bullshit. And if you don't play that game, then they start to hate you.
And I definitely like that. I like my coworkers, and that if I see them, you know, like I'll chit chat and be fun, and I don't necessarily need to like hang out with them outside of work. But that's not because I don't like them. It's just I have a lot going on. And but you know, I mean, it is nice to like your coworkers more than not. But
and great for you if you do. But
yeah, but I just I don't know. I feel bad for her. Anyway, moving on to another lady. Did you see that Rebel Wilson was saying that she's been harassed? So she is going to put out a memoir and had intimated that there's this unnamed celebrity who was awful towards her.
Uh-huh.
And the PR manager of this celebrity has basically been threatening her, saying you better not put him in your book. And of course she told everyone like this is what's happening, but didn't say who the person is. But then she finally, after a couple of days, said who it was. And it's Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh.
Who she worked with on the 2016 film Grisby. So apparently there's an entire chapter dedicated to how awful he was.
Grisby?
Do you know that movie?
I don't know if I've seen that movie.
Or did it not come out? Or I don't know. But
the Brothers Grimsby? Is that what you mean?
Did I say it wrong?
I thought there's that movie where him and Mark Strong are in the elephant's ass.
No, there's a movie called Grimsby from 2016.
The Brothers Grimsby.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess it was released as Grimsby and the Brothers Grimsby.
In the U.S., it was Brothers Grimsby.
Sorry. With Gabourey, Sidibe, mm-hmm. Some other. Penelope Cruz, Ian McShane, Isla Fisher. Oh, so Sacha Baron Cohen's wife.
You've seen it.
I've seen this movie?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, I saw the press screening alone, and then I took you to it because there was a lot of like outrageous scenes, like them being in an elephant's ass and getting shit out.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember.
Okay.
Anyway, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like, why are you harassing Rebel Wilson when it's like, no, first of all, who would be surprised that Sacha Baron Cohen is like a difficult person?
Oh, I'm not surprised.
Leave that lady alone. Let her tell her story about this awful man. His entire career is him being like kind of difficult and
making everybody angry
and making everyone uncomfortable and angry. Like, I mean, I don't think anything she's going to say will be. I think that's kind of shitty that someone who's made an entire career off of making people uncomfortable is worried that someone's going to say something uncomfortable about them.
They don't want the bad PR from this movie that's going to be a decade old soon.
Like, okay, whatever.
Okay.
You want to run down your top five releases for March?
I do. Because we've been forgetting to do that.
I know. I forgot until you mentioned it or wrote it down. So what's your number five release of March 2024?
Dune Part 2, which is rare that I think I'd put something so big budget on that. But I think it is quite good.
Number four.
The Listener. That came out this week. I reviewed it out of Venice. The Venice Film Festival 2022.
Oh.
Where it played in the Orizzonte, I believe. Right? Or was it last year? I don't remember now. Starring Tessa Thompson, and she's like a 911 phone call operator. She's on a suicide self-help line, and it's basically just her in this house talking to all these people. And I think it's a really well-written film, and I think a really great performance from Tessa Thompson.
It's not better than The Call, though.
Yes. Well, it's a completely different film.
That's impossible.
But directed by Steve Buscemi, if I didn't already say that.
No. Number three.
Dog Man, directed by Luc Besson, starring Caleb Landry Jones.
Which we have a YouTube video for.
We did, and I think you liked that as well quite a bit.
Number two.
Problemista.
It's Julio Torres' directorial debut.
Mm-hmm. And starring himself and Tilda Swinton.
Which we also have a YouTube video for.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your number one release for March?
Love Lies Bleeding.
Again, we have a video for that.
Yes, and I think you also really loved that.
Yeah.
We never talked about that magazine cover of Kristen Stewart that I guess all the Republicans were getting mad about because she's got her hand on her panties.
Oh, she's wearing a jock strap.
I love it. I love it. She also did an interview I saw recently where she was asked if she'd ever do a Marvel movie. And she basically said, like, a Marvel movie sounds like a fucking nightmare. But she's like, she'd do it if Greta Gerwig asked her.
No.
I quite like her attitude about many things.
She doesn't bother me. I can see people being...
I think she's a weirdo and she's awkward. I don't know. I like that she's been able to get to a point where she can really not give a fuck about a lot.
Which is, you know, good for her.
And that she's a fucking lesbian. I love it.
The magazine cover is a bit much. Like, I could see people feeling like...
Well, don't look. That's like people getting mad at me watching my movies on the plane. Well, don't look at my screen.
Well, but that's not really... I mean, Rolling Stone is like a major publication that's like at every, you know, newspaper stand and, you know, bookstore. And it's not that easy to avoid it, right? It's not like it's pornography that I have to go into a locked room to look at.
But it's not pornography.
I think this is a bit much. I don't dislike it. I think she looks nice. It does feel like overtly sexual in a way that I don't like. If I don't know, I could see people thinking that it's in poor taste to make this like the cover of this didn't have to be the cover, but because, you know, she's wearing a vest and like she's with nothing on underneath, so her itty bitty titties are showing, and then clearly has her hands in her, like, that's a bit much.
I love it.
It's a bit much.
I mean, but I'm, you know, I'm also always out for challenging the neuters, so, you know.
Yeah. Well.
That's just me. I don't want to live in a repressed society. I don't.
Well, there has to be a balance, because in the same conversation, a person like you might also say that children are overly sexualized. And I mean, part of that is they're exposed to a lot. But then when people try to say, like, maybe we should limit exposure.
But
then,
children are sexualized then, in the wrong way get, because they're repressed.
Then you get mad and want to say that. So how would you suggest that we limit the kind of sexual content young people are exposed to?
I don't know that they should be limited. I think that they should be educated, and it should be explained to them what it is that's exactly going on, and how we should be talking about how our bodies are feeling and how we're responding to things. And how to protect ourselves. I mean, it's, we're humans, we're sexual. Sexuality starts at a much younger age than most people will ever care to admit. So,
but if you were responsible for raising a child, don't you feel like you should do it in your own way?
I would be doing it out the gate. It would be very early.
Right, but that's your choice. What if some people feel like they want to wait, or but I can't, because every time my kid goes, you know, my 6-year-old is, I mean, in our neighborhood there, you know, there's a very nice sort of stretch where there are a lot of trendy restaurants and coffee shops, lots of families, and there's this huge newspaper stand. Mm-hmm. And Rolling Stone would be right there, and you see kids, and it's like, so I would, you know, like I go for a nice walk with my 6-year-old to go get some ice cream, and then my kid sees this, and now I have to feel like.
And that should be, if you haven't had a conversation, an excellent opportunity to talk about something worthwhile and meaningful and educational. I mean, it's just a body. Bodies are bodies. Like, we all have them. We all have genitals.
Yeah, but that's your opinion.
But no, it's a reality. We all have genitals. We all have bodies that have compunctions and
we all have desires. Fingers that can pull triggers. So should everyone have a gun? I mean, I don't know.
Grow out of my body, but a penis does. So like, yeah, it would have been nice if somebody explained things to me earlier.
So you think you
did.
Should be able to walk around with your penis hanging out?
That's not what I'm saying. But biologically, what happens?
Yeah, but that's not, but you can't say that Kristen Stewart on the cover of Rolling Stone is like this educational opportunity. She looks like.
Why can't it be? Why can it not be?
I'm not saying that it cannot be. I'm saying that what is the point of having ratings on movies and having warnings on video games and music if then just willy-nilly I can walk? Like, if I'm trying to protect my children from seeing content that I'm not ready for them to see, then
all of those things are band-aids, because we do not have a grip as a species on how to properly educate people and progress as a species. So we can't control what all these people are or aren't doing, or all the hate mongering that's spread within all these conservative homes, and how religion is used to also keep people repressed and in the dark. We can't control any of these things. So all of those things, to me, ratings are
it's not
a
about
band-aid.
Control, though. I think that attitude is like,
but it is about control.
I think any person, like anyone who talks like that, is just automatically like, you can't restrict me in any way. I can't be told anything. No one's going to tell me what I can't do. And it's like, no one's saying that you can't do any of this. We're just saying, like, I'm not saying what side I'm on, except that I can see why. When I saw the cover a week ago or whatever, I thought it was a bit much, because this is available, like it'll be on a stand on the street that anyone walking. I do think that certain things should be somewhat locked, but available. I'm not saying that you can't do these things. I just think that there are some people who don't want to see certain shit. And I think that I'm more on that side. I felt the same way about, I remember being a teenager and watching MTV Spring Break. And back in the 90s, those bikinis that were kind of, speaking of Sacha Baron Cohen, I forget what character it is, Borat. Wears that green. Mm-hmm. So back in the day, a lot of those, you know, those ladies with the perfect bodies and the fake breasts would all wear those itty bitty like string bikinis that were one piece, and they would cover up just enough of their areola and then go down and basically cover like the lips of their hairless vagina. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, this is a lot. I'm like 14 and looking at this, like, this feels like this person's basically naked. You're covering them up with dental floss. I don't know that.
But what if, and so then what's the I think the silliness of it is, why can't we be naked? They're just bodies. It's just human. It's just flesh.
But there are two different things, because you're acting like it's just this anatomical scientific thing. But the reality is, no one's just standing around like, look at my average body. That's nude. No. Anytime you see bodies, they're sexualized. So I think that's why so many people have unhealthy relationships.
But because
with
we
sex.
Sublimate and repress, if bodies were just available all the time, it would take away a lot of the mystique, and it wouldn't be so taboo. And it would just be, that's a breast that I see, mother, and it's not a dirty pillow, and it's just fine.
But I think that parents should be allowed to decide reasonably when they want to have these conversations.
Well, I think parents need to realize
which
that the
is
world,
separate
the,
from
the world is a dumpster fire, and you're not going to raise your kid at home. You're going to depend on the kindness of strangers for
but part
your
of the reason,
kid's life.
Part of the reason it's a dumpster fire is because everyone thinks they can do whatever they want, and there's no protection against anything. These kids aren't protected against anything.
That's why people should be educated and think more before they have children.
I don't agree with that. I mean, I agree that people should be educated, but I just don't think that everything should just be a free for all. Like, so like everything should just be available for everyone at any time to see.
I think it's I think you should be prepared knowing that there is really no control, that everything is a band-aid. Like you said, what is it you say yourself all the time, that shit's real flimsy out here. So realizing that, like, you need to teach your child about sex. You need to teach your child about self-protection and about...
Where's the help? Like, you're not helpful because you're telling these parents, like, get with the program. You need to be armed for battle every time you leave the house. Because
You should always be aware of your surroundings.
But aren't we a community, and shouldn't we be allowed to, like, all I'm saying is, like,
we're a community that lets people live on the streets.
Like, you don't know what it is to raise children. So you say these things like,
and I do that because I don't want to know.
Okay. But so then what makes you think that you have any, like,
but also why should I have to live my life?
You don't care about kids. You don't want kids, but then you seem to think that you know what's best for children.
Well, is the world built for children, or is the world built for adults? Childhood is a phase.
I think that's a crazy statement to make. We're all children. We all have to be children, and we should be raised
to grow into adults. So why is the world lassoed in a way that is restricted just for the pleasure of children?
It's not.
It is. That's what ratings are. That's why we have a whole film industry that wants to have PG-13 ratings on everything, because we want to appeal to 13 to adolescent minds, because we can't.
I think that we have very clear examples running around of people who did not have anything filtered, who were being sexualized when they were too young, who were seeing and reading content they shouldn't have been reading. We see what those people turn into.
Because that's so they are given that with that, they are exposed to these things without education, without understanding of how to process these
things. How can
you
give an education when it's like, I can't eat, like, I'm just imagining if I were a parent, it's like, I can't even, like, all I'm saying is that we should be helping parents sort of decide how to do these things. Who am I? Who are you? Who is anyone to tell someone who's actually raising a child, well, today's the day you need to tell them about vaginas? And it's like,
because
everyone's different. Everyone's emotional intelligence is different. Like, you know, maybe since you're so smart, maybe when you were six, you could have totally handled that. But other six-year-olds, you don't know their backgrounds. This is why parents, I think, should have the greatest part in deciding what their children are exposed to. But I don't disagree that children need to be told the truth about things, like the full truth.
Children are the unfiltered and simple. You need to tell them about their vagina and their penis and what they do.
No one's saying that you shouldn't. I'm saying that we can't have one approach to raising children. And that's why I think that we need to have safeguards in place, like ratings.
It needs to be dynamic, yes, because we are intelligent and dynamic as a species, but we send these children off to schools where we don't allow educators to educate. We make them babysitters that can't punish children that act out of bounds because they're responding in a way, they're taking the garbage that they have from home with them most times into a public setting and spoiling everything for everyone else. So everything is a band-aid, and everything has to be diminished to the lowest possible common denominator always, because we don't hold anybody accountable. And
well, you're on autopilot right now, because I think you have this automatic response to what you think is censorship.
So it's not scripted. I'm just
no, but you're going off on a rant that's like not what I'm saying. I'm saying that I do think that there should be some guidance as to the kind of content that's out there. Like, yeah, everything is a free for all, and kids do have access to a lot of crazy shit. And I totally agree that they should be well prepared and equipped to understand what these things mean. But I think, especially for someone who doesn't know what it's like to raise children, there are a lot of things that are happening in parallel with, like, oh, I might happen to walk by, you know, two men having sex in a park. And based on your logic, you think that they should be allowed to do that because kids need to understand what that is. And I would argue,
what do you think these families are that walk by with the kids in the strollers? That's what's happening at Folsom.
Yeah, but those parents or those parents are making that decision. Mm-hmm. And I'm not questioning that. But I'm saying that if I'm just trying to walk my kid to and from the bus stop and they see something overtly sexual, and it's like, well, this is not where we are today. Knowing my child, knowing how I'm trying to raise them, I'm not here today. And I think the fact that there are some people who are calling for a little more consideration in that regard gets shot down by people like you. Like, that's how you open
a little more consideration should be talking about how we allow people to just murder people.
Okay, but you're talking but you're talking about, like, I mean, that doesn't even make sense.
It's sex. It's not a big deal.
It is a big deal.
Consensual sex is not a big deal. Wow. And that is what should be instilled. And and learning people,
we can agree,
giving people to have, letting children know that they need to have agency over their bodies and what good touch and bad touch is. And that, you know, all these kids don't.
You think Kristen Stewart showing her little itty bitty titties and grabbing her crotch is somehow
in a simulation of self pleasure,
teaching children about, like, safe touch? Like, no.
Yes. Self. What is wrong with masturbation? What is wrong?
But see, you're extrapolating things that no one's saying. I think this is why liberals and progressives have a very difficult time, because it's like, no one's going to tell you anything. Like, no, like, I don't know. I don't think it's that unreasonable to feel like things that have no, like, this cover is not restricted in any way. It can just be on, like, open for everyone to see. And I can see how people would think that that's a bit much. All I'm saying is it's a bit much.
And we haven't even talked about wet ass pussy yet.
Because we're talking, you know, you talk about sex as if, I feel like people like you who talk about sex are under the assumption that people want to, like, not everyone wants to hear about you sexually. Like,
I don't want, I'm not out here talking about myself sexually. Okay, but the way you're talking, sexuality and sex need to be talked about in, remove the taboo needs to be removed. It is a human component.
An education about sex is different from sexuality just being thrown in everyone's face. People need to understand the reality of sex and their own health, right? Like, that's separate from Kristen Stewart simulating masturbation on the cover of a magazine that's everywhere. Like, I mean, which is different from an artist making a record where they're using explicit language. Like, wet ass pussy is something that can be restricted, right? Public radio stations alter the lyrics. If you buy the music or stream it, it does say that it's explicit. And there are parental barriers that they can use to block their children.
All band-aids, but yeah.
I don't know, sure, that they're band-aids. It's like, you can't, I mean, so, I mean, do you think a five-year-old should be able to get on their iPad and look at porn?
I feel like if they're exposed to it, there should be a corresponding conversation that can provide the correct parameters for a child of that age for them to understand. It shouldn't be repressed and brushed under the rug. Your kids are going to be exposed to shit. How are you going to talk to them about it in a way that is helpful?
I don't know that that logic, like, I think you're missing the part where people who decide to have children should be allowed to sort of approach their upbringing in a way that feels good for...
We have to have a license to drive cars. I think people should have a license to have children, is what I think.
Well, that's not reality, so that's not
of course
helpful.
Not. So that, again, this is why as a species, we're barely in an adolescent phase as humans, because we aren't able to deal with what exactly is happening to us. So we allow people to have children who can't teach them or educate them and send them off and want to have some kind of say about, like, the things that they don't want them exposed to that are inherent to being human, such as sex and masturbation and anatomy. And then we're surprised that we are where we are today in a dumpster fire.
Well, we need to take a break. Moving on to the restaurant section, we tried someplace called El Cholo, which apparently is touted as the first Mexican restaurant in LA. It started in 1923 with a location on Western Avenue in Mid-City. And I can't believe, I drive down that street, those cross streets. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've driven by there so many times and I've never noticed this restaurant. And my mom was actually telling me about it and saying that she wanted to go. So we went on Sunday. They have 7 locations in Southern California. We went to the one downtown. I don't know that that was the best choice because it's by LA Live, like the state, the, I forget. Oh, it's called the Crypto Center now, I think, where the yes. Lakers play. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what did you think of that restaurant?
It was very cute inside. The service was questionable. And okay, the chips were fine because, you know, at almost every Mexican restaurant, you get chips and salsa. That salsa was no good. That was paste picante.
That salsa tasted like they took...
They sprinkled some cilantro on it.
It almost tasted like they took how you can buy the diced tomatoes that are seasoned mm-hmm. in a can, and then they added their own little extra because it wasn't spicy. Mm-hmm. And it did have a weird... It was like a little too wet, a little too...
It was wet and very chunky.
Mm-hmm. Which was a weird combination. Yeah, it almost like they mixed two things together and just dumped them in a bowl without trying to mix them together. But yeah, I thought the food was fine.
I got fish tacos and my fish was really tough.
Oh.
It was really tough. Yeah.
Would I go there again? No. I might. The original one is closer to our home, so I might try that. Like give it a second try.
Yeah. What did you get again?
I got chili verde.
That's right.
So like it's like a brisket, I guess, basically.
And your mom got chili relleno.
And she got a chili relleno, yeah.
Which she likes a lot.
She likes them. I didn't dislike my food. I will say they gave me enough tortillas. You know, sometimes you only get like two little tortillas for all that food. And it's like, how am I supposed to finish?
The rice and beans were good. My food was fine. And the flavor of the fish wasn't the problem, but it was, I don't know that I've ever had fish so tough. You know how when chicken can get tough?
Yeah.
It had kind of that. It was just overcooked. But again, I would rather have overcooked than undercooked fish. So I guess I shouldn't complain.
The service was questionable. The lady seemed... She almost looked scared.
She, yeah.
Like she was giving me like Mexican Octavia Spencer and she kept looking like she was hiding from someone or something.
like the Antichrist might be one of her clients at any given moment. Yeah.
Yeah. So she, she wasn't very attentive and she seemed to kind of want to like rush her. But yeah, I wouldn't. The other thing is parking down there is difficult and expensive.
Well, you had to pay for parking, so of course that was bothersome to you.
yeah because it's by a big venue, so parking was like $45, $50. I luckily found a $20 spot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would still be willing to give the mid-city spot a try. Mm-hmm. We ordered drinks. I liked mine. Overall I thought it was a little spendy.
Most places like that are, though.
Although I shouldn't say that because when the total bill came, I was surprised it wasn't more. But yeah, I don't know. Spending more than $20 for a plate of rice and beans and like a thing to me, well, I just have a hard time getting used to that. Uh-huh. Yeah. Like $28 for, I don't know. But El Cholo. Mm-hmm.
And I was just in Puerto Rico for 5 days. And since I was only there during the week, I don't think I had an opportunity to eat at a lot of restaurants, but there's a lot of camarones. So, you know, I ate some good shrimp and there was good rice and beans. But the hotel I was staying in, which is a very nice hotel, their breakfast that they had, which they were asking $25 every morning for, was terrible. Que terrible. That was one of the worst breakfast offerings outside of London. Because I've been stuck in London a few times after missing flights out of Heathrow, and they always shutter you off on, you know, some hotel they have a deal with for those kind of situations, and the food that they always offer that's complimentary is terrible. And that's what it reminded me of.
I don't know why this is coming to my head, but I remember when we drove from Minneapolis to LA with the blue Saab, towing it. We stopped maybe in like, oh God, was it Iowa?
Nebraska.
Was it Nebraska? No, I'm not thinking of that Mexican restaurant. Oh, we stopped somewhere to stay at a hotel.
That might have been Iowa.
And it was really sketchy. And I remember the guy was kind of weird that we had asked for one bed. But I remember they had like breakfast in the morning at this mm-hmm. shit place. And I recall thinking that was like a nightmare. Mm-hmm. Like I would never eat anything out of this place.
Not even the yogurt that is sealed. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh God. Well, any other food stories from Puerto Rico?
Besides the terrible breakfast? No. No. I didn't really eat any sweets. I brought you home some brownies. Oh, you know, I've never had this happen anywhere. This lovely young woman, I think the place was called Zombie Coffee, and I was staying in Old San Juan, which I wouldn't recommend staying in Old San Juan because it felt too touristy for me. It was also very sleepy feeling in Puerto Rico, and people drive. I rented a car. People were driving entirely too slow for me. But you understand why at night, because there are not a lot of lights and there are lots of twists and turns and potholes. So there's probably a reason for people driving slow. But the hotel I was in was right by where all these huge cruise liners would dock. So just every day there were three to four huge cruise ships docking, you know, for hours at a time, and all of these people milling around. So that was I didn't enjoy that. I think if I went again, I would stay in the Condado region, which I enjoyed a little bit more. And walking around at night was really nice. But anyway, the Zombie Coffee thing, the woman gave me my coffee and she's like, you know, it's really hot. Would you like a couple ice cubes? And I felt seen.
Mm-hmm. Films released we didn't cover. In the Land of Saints and Sinners.
Directed by Robert Lorenz. It stars Liam Neeson and I believe, what's her name from Banshees of Inisherin, Carrie Condon. You passed on this, reviewing it, but we reviewed his last film with Liam Neeson, The Marksman, which was terrible. Mm. So that's probably fine. And he also directed Trouble with the Curve, which I still have not seen.
Asphalt City.
When I saw this at Cannes last year, it was called Black Flies.
Oh.
And we almost reviewed this.
Yeah.
I have a written review out there for it, but it's by Jean-Stéphane Sauvert, and it stars Sean Penn and Ty Sheridan, and Callie Reese, recently of season 4 of True Detective, has a small part in it. And it's about two ambulance drivers in New York City from the perspective of a French filmmaker. Sean Penn has seemed out of touch to me for a long time. It is a decent movie. We almost watched it. We had a screener for it.
La Chimera.
The new film by Alice Rohrwacher, which was also at Cannes last year in 2023, which I did quite enjoy. You weren't interested in seeing it from what I remember. But it's about an English archaeologist student played by Josh O'Connor, who is looking for I'm forgetting quite what happens now, but there are these grave robbers looting Etruscan tombs, and he is staying with this older woman played by Isabella Rossellini, who I thought was quite entertaining. Anyway, I thought it was kind of with a slow setup, otherwise pretty fun film. Oh, and Alba Rohrwacher has a really fun, Alice's sister has a fun role in it as well.
The Listener.
I think I just talked about this, directed by Steve Buscemi with Tessa Thompson. I highly recommend checking this film out.
Lousy Carter.
This sounded interesting, directed by Bob Byington, which I have not seen, but it's about a man who's described as a man baby who's trying to complete an animated adaptation of Nabokov and is teaching a senior seminar on the Great Gatsby, and apparently he only has 6 months to live.
Oh. Steve.
Martin, a documentary in two pieces. Apple TV just released this weekend. I thought, were quite a big fan of Steve Martin, and you were adamant about not watching this.
Yeah. I mean, I like Steve Martin, but I don't know that I care about his life enough to watch a documentary.
Really? Okay.
I don't know. I whenever I see him that he's in a movie, that will get me to want to watch it. But for some reason, just learning more about the man is not necessary to me at all.
Okay. Well, Morgan Neville directed it, who also did 20 Feet from Stardom and that one about Mr. Rogers. Yeah. I don't know. So it's out there for your pleasure.
The Wages of Fear.
So really daring that the director Julien Leclerc thought that he needed to remake the classic Henri-Georges Clouzet film, The Wages of Fear.
Well, that title sounds familiar.
Yeah, this is a classic film that actually has been remade a couple of times, most notably and quite well by William Friedkin in the Roy Scheider starring Sorcerer, which I also highly recommend. Julien Leclerc directed, I don't know, 9 or 10 films. The only one that I've seen was at my first Toronto Film Festival back in 2007, a sci-fi film called Chrysalis, which I haven't seen since then, but I remember thinking it was kind of so-so. But anyway, Netflix has released this French remake of a very famous French film, and it's out there for people to watch. I didn't see it yet.
This past week on our Patreon, we reviewed Tales from the Hood and Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
So people can go listen to those. Unfortunately, there are entries in the obituaries section. There is a young actor named Chance Perdomo.
Who died in a motorcycle accident?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with this person. He was 27. He's known for some shows called Chilling Adventures of Sabrina and Gen V, or is it Gen 5?
I think it's Gen V.
Okay. But yeah, there are no details on the accident. Although that makes me, these goddamn motorcycles.
I mean, I don't want to be on one.
I can see living in a more like country area where there are more wide open roads and less congestion, but living in LA and seeing these, the way people ride these motorcycles is like, it feels like you have a death wish.
Yes.
They just go in and out of traffic going so fast. And people in LA are very, I don't think we're aggressive drivers. I think people are very inconsiderate because they're just impatient. Like traffic's bad. It's annoying. So people don't give a shit. People don't use indicators. People cut you off. And I think, yeah, riding a motorcycle just sounds like the worst idea. But I don't know where this crash happened, but obviously... sad for such a young person.
Yeah, for sure.
And then, of course, Louis Gossett Jr. died.
Yes.
You have provided a list of some of your favorite films of his.
Yes. Outside of his Oscar-winning role, of course.
He died at the age of 87. Yeah.
So some other films. I mean, he worked a lot. But, and I think the majority of my favorite films of his were from the 70s and 80s. So to honor him, to suggest some things that to catch up on, if you haven't, that I think he has fun roles in, one being Peter Yates' The Deep, which is an adapt from the Peter Benchley novel, who's the author of Jaws, and also stars Nick Nolte and Jacqueline Bisset. And I remember a very weird moment with a chicken claw, but... I like that film. Also, The Landlord, an early Hal Ashby film, which has interesting roles for Pearl Bailey and Lee Grant. That's that clip that I showed you about you got to be a whole lot badder and blacker.
Oh, yeah.
There's some fun things in that, but Louis Gossett Jr.'s in there. And I don't think you've even seen that whole movie, but I really like 70s era Hal Ashby overall. Also from the 70s, The Laughing Policeman, with Walter Matthau in the lead role, but it's about a gunman opening fire in on a bus in San Francisco, and this sergeant is trying to solve the case, and it also stars Bruce Dern, and it's from the director of Cool Hand Luke, Stuart Rosenberg. The Choir Boys, which in our last house, I had this on because I got the Blu-ray. I don't know if it's about a bunch of cops led by kind of this the biggest loser of them all, played by Charles Durning, and it's directed by Robert Aldrich, the director of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. I don't know if you remember this. They have the one like flamboyant homosexual that they tie to a tree in that park or whatever.
Oh,
I don't know if you remember that film. It's just an okay film overall, but it's fun to see all of these people in it. And it's, I remember seeing it as a kid and it had a kind of a bigger impression on me. Gossett Jr. is also in one of my favorite blaxploitation films of all time, JD's Revenge, which I know we have not reviewed, but I've brought up many, many times in the past. But I think my favorite Louis Gossett Jr. film, and I think would make a fun secret film one day, is called Enemy Mine. It's directed by Wolfgang Peterson from 85, I think. And it stars Dennis Quaid and Louis Gossett Jr. as an alien who I remember. I haven't watched this in years and years and years, but I remember specifically a scene where Louis Gossett Jr. is this alien there. He's pregnant and gives birth.
What?
And Dennis Quaid helps him through the labor. I can't believe
it. Is it fun?
It is fun. I love it. Yeah. It's a weird little sci-fi film from the 80s. Well, not little, but that was a notable film.
Oh God. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take another break. The secret film this week was my choice, and I chose the 1982 American romantic drama film, An Officer and a Gentleman, in honor of Louis Gossett Jr., who won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, making him the first Black man to do so.
Well, and the third Black actor, yeah, so to win supporting, and the third Black actor overall to win an Oscar.
The first, of course, was
Hattie McDaniel.
Yes.
And then Sidney Poitier.
So, yeah, I had never seen this movie. Neither had you.
Correct.
So this was a good choice for that purpose.
Uh-huh. Fills in a big hole from 80s films I have not seen.
What is it about? A young man must complete his work at a Navy officer candidate school to become an aviator with the help of a tough gunnery sergeant and his new girlfriend. I did not care for this movie.
I didn't, you know, a reason this was not a film I watched as a kid growing up is my mom didn't like this movie.
It's very lukewarm to me.
I feel the same way, and I don't understand any of the dramatic conflicts, really.
And much respect to Louis Gossett Jr., but I'm surprised he won an Academy Award for this performance.
I kind of am too.
Who was he up against that year?
What's his nuts from Victor Victoria? Oh God, I'm forgetting who, but you know who I thought should have won in that category was John Lithgow for The World According to Garp, playing the trans football player.
Well, let me tell the quick story. So this young man is played by Richard Gere, mm-hmm. and we see that he wants to fly jets. So he goes to this Navy officer candidate school, and we're told that the training is 13 weeks. So the movie is set during that 13-week period. And during that time, he makes a good friend played by David Keith. And we also hear of these women who are referred to as Puget Debs. And basically, they're like these working class heifers who live across the bay who come over during the weekends to try to scoop up a Navy man. Mm-hmm. Like they want to marry an Air Force pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait, no. Not Navy, our Air Force. Mm-hmm. they want a military man, basically. So we see these two women, one played by Deborah Winger.
Mm-hmm.
Is the other one notable?
Lisa Blount playing Lynette. I made the comment that I know not every Lynette. I've known several Lynettes back in Minnesota who were kind of white trash blondes, and so that felt like an apt name for this character. But I haven't. She's also in Prince of Darkness, a John Carpenter film.
So the plot is sort of like two main things running in parallel. One is the basic training aspect of it, which is very, very lukewarm to me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem that rigorous or it's almost comical at times. And then there's the plot between the two Puget Debs and Richard Gere and David Keith. And Louis Gossett Jr. plays the gunnery sergeant, Foley.
Mm-hmm.
And he's this tough, I mean, just every stereotype of like a basic training sergeant, like he's that.
Mm-hmm.
And right away he tells all the guys and the one girl in, who's the girl? The lady.
Lisa Eilbacher.
Do we know her?
She was all over stuff in the early 80s. And I think she's still alive, has kind of, I think is retired now, but she was in a bunch of notable stuff around then. She's including Beverly Hills Cop and Charles Bronson film that I kind of like called 10 to Midnight.
She's memorable to me in this movie because her last name is Seeger, mm-hmm. but Louis Gossett Jr. is saying her name like Seeger.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Louis Gossett Jr. tells all the new people, all the men, like, just so y'all know, these ladies come out here trying to trap you. They're going to say they're pregnant. So just keep your zipper up and steer clear.
And there's no doubt about that, because then we get the women talking about how they trap men.
Yeah. And immediately, while not even immediately, while Louis Gossett Jr. is telling these people this, we see Deborah Winger and Lisa Blount getting ready to go over to see the military guys. And they even flirt with them while they're doing push-ups. So, of course, both of the men get hemmed up. David Keith more so than Richard Gere. However, Richard Gere is the star. And then the romantic element, this love story to me feels so weak. I mean, it's not as bad as the one in Top Gun, where it's like, where did this
come from? Oh, with Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis. Yeah.
It's not that ridiculous, but it just like, I don't understand where all this passion came from. But of course, everything culminates in training being over. And what are these guys going to do? So David Keith's character, he has an unfortunate ending to his, which we can get to, but we're more focused on Richard Gere. And he decides to ghost
Deborah Winger. He ghosts Deborah Winger. Mm-hmm.
But it's important to know his backstory. He was raised by his single mom because his dad just ran off. Mm-hmm. And his dad was a military man.
Played by Robert Loggia.
But Richard Gere's mom, when he was like a young boy, like 10 or 11, killed herself. Mm-hmm. So Richard Gere had to go live with his dad. But his dad was like, I am not interested in being a dad or your dad. So we get the sense that for the next 10 to 12 years, Richard Gere looks a little old. Richard Gere is very handsome in this movie.
He's very handsome.
He's definitely a snack, but he doesn't look as young as I think he's supposed to be.
He's like 33 here, and the character is written for a character that should be in their early 20s.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I got the sense that he's supposed to be in his early 20s, so we'll just go with that. So mm-hmm. So for the next 12 years, as this young man is living with his dad, it looks like his dad treats him like one of his buddies. Like they go out and find women and have sex together, like, you know, like have orgies together mm-hmm. and drink and party. So his dad ain't shit. Although according to you, that would be a healthy upbringing because he got an education. But anyway.
I don't think that's a healthy upbringing.
Oh, that's not okay?
No, that's...
His dad was showing him firsthand.
That's not at all. You're twisting words now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like education in a safe, loving environment where we're not treating sex like it's some evil, dark thing.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
But anyway, his dad ain't shit. So it's important. God, this... I feel like this aspect of the character was just swept under the rug in this movie, but we see that that's partially why he treats women, specifically Deborah Winger, the way he does.
I think that's the overall theme of the film, is that these people are subject to repeating the behaviors that were instilled in them.
Yes.
Because the Deborah Winger character, whose mother is played by the great Grace Zabriskie, is also saying that she wants to not end up in the factory unhappy like her mom.
Anyway, Richard graduates, and we think that he's just going to move on without Deborah Winger. But the final scene of the film is that she works in like a paper factory, mm-hmm. and he goes to the factory. And the corniest scene, that is also the final scene, is he walks in, grabs her, kisses her, and walks out with her.
It shuts down production.
Shuts down production. All the people working basically walk out to the exit and watch her leave, like they're clapping for her.
And Lynette's like, good job.
But there's so many other things going on, but that's the basic story. Mm-hmm. I think that this film is so lukewarm because it's like a basic training procedural that paints basic training as like not that big of a deal. But then you have this caricature of a sergeant played by Louis Gossett Jr. who's constantly screaming and telling these people that he basically like, I can destroy you, and half mm-hmm. the people here are not going to make it. And then we see that only two people
drop out
mm-hmm. and they resign. He doesn't kick them out. And then like the only violent moments, I don't know. It almost feels like a comedy, the basic training portion of it.
Yes.
Like what's the one with Damon, Major Payne?
Major Payne. Yeah. It doesn't need to be Full Metal Jacket, but
that's an exaggeration. It's definitely not a comedy like Major Payne, but I felt like Louis Gossett Jr.'s characterization felt on the level of Major Payne.
So I've been thinking since we watched it, and in light of another recent movie that came out, The American Society of Magical Negroes, I think that the Sergeant Foley is kind of a rough around the edges magical Negro. If you think about it, because we get no backstory on him, his relationship with the Richard Gere character culminates and then in fisticuffs, which Richard Gere is still allowed to graduate this program, which is baffling, which we'll get more into. And for what? Like
that's an interesting point, because the only character who seems to be afraid of Louis Gossett Jr. is the black character.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is white, except for someone, I forget his name.
Oh, Emiliano de la Serra.
Yeah, he is Latino. He seems to be concerned, but the white, you know, and they're all these handsome young white men, mm-hmm. don't seem bothered by Louis Gossett Jr.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, played by David Caruso, he's like, that's illegal for him to touch me. Like, yeah. They don't even, and the reality is Louis Gossett Jr. doesn't do shit to anybody. And then even the staff, there's a scene where towards the end when Louis Gossett Jr. has to get up during the graduation and all those white people on the stage, like the people in charge of the base or whatever, they don't even like look at him.
No, no. There's one man that's clearly looking the other way, and the other woman looks like, as you said, she. You made some comment like, "I bet she doesn't like colored people."
Yeah, like why is she looking at him like that?
But yeah, he again, not to keep saying the same phrase over and over again, but it kind of has that taint of the magical Negro who is just there to service the needs and better the lives of these white people. Because there's one scene where Richard Gere is also Zach Mayo, I think his name is. He is selling buckles and shoes that he is getting from some supplier at exorbitant rates to his fellow cohorts, and he gets caught by Louis Gossett Jr. So it ends up with him being tortured basically physically through physical exercise by Gossett Jr. one weekend. And that culminates in a scene where Richard Gere breaks down and starts sobbing about how he has nowhere to go. And we see Foley look at him with pity, like, oh, well, I'll let you stay.
Well, it's like Louis Gossett Jr. sacrificed his weekend where he could have been free. He spends the entire weekend trying to like whip Richard Gere into shape for him to ultimately realize that, you know, he belongs there. Yeah, it's like this character, the sole purpose of Gossett Jr.'s character is to like help this kid do better,
realize his potential, his the error in his ways. There, he's
isn't made, your job to find good military men, right? Like, I don't understand.
Richard Gere, he has him doing push-ups in the mud, putting his, and he's like, I read your file, your father's a whoremonger. And it's like, that's in his file? Why is that in his file?
Also, Louis Gossett Jr.'s character during that scene is like getting in the mud with him, so now he's all dirty, mm-hmm. and it's just like, not this, not for this fool. Also, the film does a poor, like the story does a poor job of explaining what they're looking for during basic training, because I would think that they have to demonstrate some sort of knowledge of like aerodynamics and science, because we do see them in a class where Richard Gere is not performing. Mm-hmm. Like he doesn't understand how to do this math. So to me, it's like, I don't think Richard Gere would make a good pilot.
No,
why are we even going through this?
So, and it ends in a way that's like, he's not going to go far.
Well, we can, so here, there's so much to say. I have so many notes. So in the opening of the film, we see Richard Gere as an adult with his dad after they had a long night having an orgy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when Richard Gere tells his dad, I'm joining the Navy. And his dad is mad. And then, was that when he was a kid where he tells his dad that his...
We're getting flashbacks in that scene.
Oh, and then you hear the dad yell, that's a female lie.
Yeah. But then the kid goes, I read your letters after she killed herself and you said you were coming back.
That's right. It was when he was a kid and he's like, you told mom you were coming back. And he's like, that's a female lie.
I
read the letters you said. So his dad is awful.
Yes.
But then for some reason stayed with him. Also, Richard Gere's character says that he spent all those years living on top of like the most disgusting whorehouse in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
But then Richard Gere looks like this little perfect white angel, mm-hmm. minus kind of a shitty tattoo on his arm.
That is a shitty tattoo, yeah.
So it just, like, I don't think Richard Gere was the right actor for this role.
No, he's too old.
We needed someone younger who was a little more, like, dirty, but sexy. Like someone who clearly was raised in a way where they kind of did whatever they, like, they were a product of the streets, basically. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't know. His acting is a little.
I like Richard Gere. I do too. He'd already been in major films by then, like Days of Heaven, which I love, and American Gigolo, which I also love. And you actually referenced Gigolo watching this because of the Blondie song Call Me and how that is used.
Well, here, let's talk about that. So in American Gigolo, the Blondie song Call Me is used, but it's done in such an inventive way because we get different genres of the song, basically. Mm-hmm. There's like a disco version, an acoustic version, mm-hmm. the original version. So I think it's such a cool way. I thought the way they handle that's so cool. Like that, how they manipulate this one song to fit the mood of the scene. But this damn movie, that song Up Where We Belong, mm-hmm. which I think is such an awkward song title because the lyrics are love, lift us up where we belong. Mm-hmm. So to call it Up Where We Belong, like what? Performed by Joe Cocker and
what's her name? Linda, Brenda.
If you don't recognize what I'm saying, you've heard the song before.
You have heard, this is a major song from the 80s. This was
written specifically for this movie.
As major as Berlin's, what's it called? It's song for Top Gun.
Oh yeah.
I mean, yes.
Yeah, you know this song, but they play this song incessantly throughout the film, mainly an instrumental version.
Yes.
But it's just, I mean, it's comical. If you had a drinking game every time the song comes up. But then it's like this romance between Richard Gere and Deborah Winger is not warranting these lyrics. Like,
he's so goddamn rude to her. Because he knocks some guy out at a bar because they meet these girls at a bar and then they're going to go, they leave the bar to go get hotel rooms to have sex. And then there's an altercation and then he's in a bad mood. And I think you went to pee at this moment because he's telling Deborah Winger, okay, take your clothes off. I'll give you a good fuck.
Yeah, but it was just so heavy handed. Like, oh, okay, because he had this background in the Philippines, that this is how he treats women. But then Richard Gere, the actor, is not presenting as someone who would behave this way. He seems like he'd be the sweet, sensitive type.
Kind of, yeah.
When Louis Gossett Jr. meets the new recruits, one of the guys is from Oklahoma, and Louis Gossett Jr. says only two things come out of Oklahoma, steers and queers. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be the perfect name for a gay bar.
Yeah.
And I was trying to look up, like, are there any gay bars named steers and queers? There are, like, nights where they'll
that's
call
the theme night.
But I'm saying someone needs like a sign that says steers and queers
in Texas,
and it should be like a bar where they do like that, even though I don't like line dancing.
I abhor it. Yes.
There used to be a gay bar in Studio City called
Oil Can Harry's,
and I don't think it's there anymore.
I think it is gone. Yeah,
but they were very popular for line dancing.
Well, they had a disco night too, I think.
They had an upstairs where there was karaoke. Yeah. I actually wish I would have gone there more because I kind of like the vibe. And also at the door they had a box of Red Vines that you could.
That's right. Look at your little memory go about the Red Vines. Okay.
Well, that's because it's attached to something I like, the Red Vines. I thought Richard Gere's last name is Mayo, and Louis Gossett Jr. keeps calling him mayonnaise, which made me think of Christine's African mayonnaise.
Oh, I forgot about that. Well, the video is fun for that song.
So I knew nothing about this movie, and when I looked it up, I'm like, oh, David Keith is in it. And then when we see him, I'm like, oh, I thought it was going to be Keith David.
As a kid, I always got those two mixed up because they were notable around the same time.
Because I really like Keith David.
Because this is the same year as The Thing.
But David Keith is very handsome.
I remember thinking that as a kid. He did some movie with Diane Wiest because I had a Diane Wiest phase. And I still have the clamshell VHS of this called Independence Day. And he was also in a film I really like called White of the Eye with Kathy Moriarty.
Well, David Keith's character, when he first sees the Puget Debs, he says it more than once. He's like, God, what a bodacious set of tatas.
You on Lynette, who looks like a drowned, harassed rat.
You know what this movie, I feel like we're going to go over time. This movie so there's a lot of cringy language used in this film. Mm-hmm. Related to sexuality and race and nationality. But it made me think that we really need to be more patient with people sort of evolving with how language is changing. So like immediately I thought of like the use of pronouns and how some people are struggling and we're all making mistakes. And I think we really do need to be more patient, because it wasn't too long ago that people felt free to say any old thing.
Oh yeah.
So you think like your the way your dad talks, my dad, my mom, well, I don't talk to my dad, but even back then, but you think like people, like, I mean, I'm not young, but even someone younger than me, like your parents used to say some wild shit, right? And probably still do. So you think, okay, now all of a sudden we expect everyone to be very careful with their language, and it's like, I don't know. We need to be a little more patient, because I mean, watching this movie, I was just like, God.
Oh yeah. He's using like,
and it's not even the worst language you hear in some movies.
But it's just, we were listening to Patrice O'Neill and talking about like the new racism and how he's like, white people used to be out here saying like, I hate N-words.
Yeah. And now you can't do that. That's why white people are so angry right now. Cause they can't. They can't show their true colors.
Like just sing-songy. Like
just... Yeah. But, oh God, there's like a, I thought it was so weird that one of the like women who works on the, like the candidate school, she hosts like these Deb balls.
Yeah.
Which feels like prostitution.
Basically.
Like, so, you know, why would you have an event where all these men are stuck together for 13 weeks who are not supposed to be fraternizing with women? Mm-hmm. And then you give them like this one night where they get to meet women, you know, some shit's going to go down, but
they're walking in the spider web. Here.
But we see this one girl. So she's like a brunette. She has long, straight hair, center part, concentrated cut. And she has like the two front sections. She has bows in her hair.
I was screaming. That was so ugly.
That was the ugliest use of bows
I've ever seen.
The most pointless use of bows I have ever seen.
Like, girl, what was that for?
I hope that I can find a picture of it to post, because I just didn't understand.
And that's
who thought that was cute.
I think that's the one Emiliano's De La Serra takes to dance with. And it's like, you chose her with those dumb bows? Good luck.
So then all of a sudden we jump to a scene where Louis Gossett Jr. is on his Jean-Claude Van Damme shit, because he's on this like bandstand podium shirtless doing like, hi-ya, judo chop. Like, and then he wants to demonstrate how important it is to be a fighter, because he's saying we're not stupid. We know all you guys come here to get you know, this pilot education is worth $1 million, but you get it for free because you're in the Navy. But we know that you're just going to finish your 6 years and go to fly for like American Airlines or whatever. So he's like, you know, it's all fun and games until you're actually in combat and you have to know how to defend yourself. So he chooses David Caruso, and Caruso's like, he can't touch me. That's against the law. And then, of course, Louis Gossett Jr. like damn near strangles his ass. But I thought that scene was laughable. I definitely didn't take it seriously.
No.
It's also during that scene where they're wearing the little sweatsuits, like those sweatpants, sweatshirt combos that I remember wearing in middle school PE. And I was so triggered. I hated having to get undressed in the locker room.
I hated
having to put on those nasty clothes. They all smelled horrible. And they were so uncomfortable. And then they're all wearing like flat shoes as like running
I remember my gym bag. I had my uncle who ran a Yonkers. Remember that store?
You had an uncle who ran a Yonkers? Really?
Yeah, in Michigan.
I didn't know that.
He gave me free Michael Jordan.
Really?
Cologne. Yeah.
Did you ever go to his store?
Yeah, one summer I worked. He paid me out of the petty cash in the safe, and I worked for him one summer.
Did you like that?
Yeah, because I was kind of left to my own devices, and whatever I was doing, they thought was a good job, but I don't know.
Well, we all know that couldn't have been true. There's a point, which I thought was a funny scene. Richard Gere and David Keith go to, this is after they've met the two ladies. They're at like a local bar, and it's a bunch of like college type, you know, granola-y guys in there who are like anti-war. And they confront Richard Gere and David Keith, calling them warmongers. Mm-hmm. And they confront them like they want to do something, which I thought was so funny. Like a bunch of old soft ass dudes who are against war.
Who have been drinking.
Why would you approach military men?
Right.
And what happens is what I wanted to happen, which is Richard Gere whoops all their asses.
No, actually just one.
Oh, it's just the one?
Just the one guy, yeah.
And they're so mad, but it's like, you were picking on him.
That, right. And then
violence is not, I don't agree with violence, but sometimes people need their asses whooped.
But then the man who clearly won the fight, you are calling the F slur and an asshole. And it's like,
you called him the F slur while he's like trying to leave with some ladies and he just whooped your ass.
Yeah.
It's like, none of this makes sense.
Right.
None of it makes sense. So then we cut to a scene where all of the candidates have to do, or the trainees have to do water training, where it's supposed to mimic like their jet crash landing into the ocean
in a contraption that looks like it's designed to fuck up your back.
Oh, that was my first thought, was like, I'm gonna have like back issues. Yeah, from this.
It's like a bad ride at Magic Mountain where you're just like, God, I'm need the chiropractor.
But of course, the one black man in the training who I recognize,
Harold Sylvester,
he's the first one to go and he has a hard time, but he gets to go again. He gets a second chance, doesn't he?
I don't remember.
But of course, Richard Gere goes and he does well. The lady Seagar goes. She does well. And then David Caruso goes. And we got a hint earlier on that he's like afraid of water. Mm-hmm. Like you want to fly jets for the Navy and you're afraid of water. And he, of course, has like a panic attack and like almost drowns. And Louis Gossett Jr. has to resuscitate him. And then I thought it was so weird that it seems like Louis Gossett Jr. was affected by it.
Yes.
But then we cut to the next scene and he's just walking around with no mention of it. Like mm-hmm. everything's fine. I almost think maybe the script was like tinkered with a lot.
Maybe. I mean,
what year is Top Gun?
Top Gun is 86.
86.
This is 82. And yeah. This is directed by Taylor Hackford. One of his, he directed something before this, but this is kind of the first big hit for him. And after this, he made a film called Against All Odds, which is a remake of a classic film noir that I love called Out of the Past. I've never seen Against All Odds. My mother, again, to, you know, your parents have a large influence over your tastes growing up. She hated Rachel Ward, who stars in that movie. And she hated Rachel Ward because she was so mad that she was cast in the adaptation of The Thornbirds, one of her favorite books. You've never seen The Thornbirds. That would be fun to That'd be really fun to revisit sometime. But anyway, yes. So the early Taylor Hackford films were not watched in our house.
If anyone has gone through basic training, someone needs to help me understand this situation with doing, because every movie, we just reviewed that Gabrielle Union movie, not just like last year, about the gay guy in Basic Training.
Oh, yeah,
we
yeah.
went to the mm-hmm. premiere or whatever.
Well, we went to an award.
We went to a screening where Gabrielle Union was there talking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But like every movie like this, you get them like where the sergeant will come in and check their room and make sure like their shirt is ironed and their shoes are shiny. But in this movie, we see that Richard Gere is like doing something on the side where he's selling boots
buckles.
And buckles that are already shined mm-hmm. because they can't shine them themselves. And I'm so confused by this. I don't understand the issue with the buckle. So you want me to have a perfectly shiny buckle.
But then I don't have the ability to.
But I don't have access. I don't understand. I'm so confused by it. I understand doing checks where it's like you need to keep your room orderly and mm-hmm. you have to be ready when we say you're ready. That all makes sense to me. But I don't get like if my shoes get scuffed up from working and my buckle gets scratched from lifting shit you told me to lift. Unless you're going to provide me with a new buckle and new shoes, what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. And then the one black man, he can't get his buckle shined properly, which then made me think, is he stupid or is the buckle scratched?
But then it's like, you know that well in advance. And then 5 minutes before the inspection happens, he is begging Richard Gere.
He's panicking.
But Richard Gere has to open the... What do they call that?
The ceiling tiles where he keeps his stash.
And it's like, I won't have time before he gets here. It's like,
but I don't understand. Like you said, so 5 minutes before now you're panicking.
Like, didn't you all sleep in there that night? Couldn't you have been like, hey, I need a buckle.
You know, I didn't try to look this up, but if anyone knows, I'm just so curious why this is such a big deal and why like
how there wasn't a better workaround for people.
Okay. We have to take another break. So 1 hour into the film is where we get what you already sort of alluded to as to maybe the basic theme of the film. And this is when Richard Gere gets caught selling bootleg shiny shoes and buckles that Louis Gossett Jr. says, well, I'm going to break you down so you quit. So I'm going to spend my whole ass weekend making you do push-ups. And then at a point, Richard finally breaks down and screams, I got nowhere else to go. And that's when we realize, like, oh, this is why he's here. Now, it's obvious from the opening when he tells his dad he's joining, because it's like, yeah, I mean, what else is he going to do? He has this shit life with his shit dad. Mm-hmm. But I just, I don't know that, I don't think the script does a good job of honing in on any theme in particular. So by the end, it all felt very diluted to me.
It did, and it felt very long. And like, why are
it
we
did feel very long.
Why are we focusing on the, I mean, this is from Douglas Day Stewart, who previous to this wrote The Blue Lagoon, which I've also never seen. And a film we have seen is The Boy in the Plastic Bubble with John Travolta.
John Travolta? So then another theme that I think could have made for an awesome movie is that Richard goes to meet Paula, Deborah Winger's parents, mm-hmm. and the dad.
Stepdad.
And,
I think it's a stepdad.
Yeah, her stepdad. And like her brother and sister, I think. Mm-hmm. And the stepdad is not feeling Richard Gere at all. So then Richard Gere's like, well, let's go. He's kind of rude. Like
very rude.
Mm-hmm. And then he leaves. And then that's when Deborah Winger says, well, my real dad was like a Navy officer, but he left 22 years ago. So I,
and she shows, she has a picture that she clearly took out of an album and it looks like Richard Gere.
Yes. So I thought, because then we also get a scene at the print shop or the paper factory with the other ladies in the break room. And one of them is real nasty about the other, Deborah Winger and her friend Lynette, mm-hmm. basically saying like, you dumb bitches. It reminded me of Poetic Justice when
in the salon,
no, in the hotel room right before the hair show. When old girl tells Janet, like, you wouldn't know your pussy from a hole in the ground. That's how I felt during this scene, like in the break room. And I thought that would have made such a great movie. Like all these women trying to catch a military man, but they just make it so like, that would have been so much more interesting to me. Cause even that one lady, her one scene I thought was, actually, talking about supporting actor, I felt like her little 30 seconds had more impact than Louis Gossett Jr. Because I got a sense of what the town felt like and like how all these women have this dead-end job at this print factory and their only salvation is to marry a military man.
Right.
And like you mentioned as we were watching it, like there's no mention of like, has anyone tried to leave? Has anyone tried to like go to school? Like,
yeah, you know, you can go
do
back
any of these
school.
Women want to have a career beyond this? Like,
oh, and the actress that you're referencing from Poetic Justice is the great Tyra Farrell.
Tyra Farrell. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. I was so confused towards the end, like the third act, because it seems like they have graduated from the training. Like we thought they had graduated.
Right. And then they're like, oh, there's another week. Okay.
And they have like a little ceremony and then it's like, oh, there's another week. And then there is a graduation. That's when it really felt like it was being dragged out. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we didn't talk about David Keith's character fully. So his dad is an officer in the Navy. His brother completed basic training, but was killed in combat. Mm-hmm. So David Keith is here and we realize that he's only doing this to sort of follow in the footsteps of his dad and brother.
And he's been betrothed to his dead brother's fiance.
That took me out. Uh-huh. Like he's been promised to basically marry his dead brother's fiance.
And we meet his shitty parents, who is also a foreboding scene because the dad makes a point of saying like, my day when I did this, you couldn't just drop out. They made you a swabby.
So yeah, but of course, David Keith is seeing Lynette, so he's having a romance. And then they keep sort of hinting at like the way these women trap these men is they tell them they're pregnant. Mm-hmm. So of course, Lynette tells David Keith she's pregnant.
She says that her period's late.
And I was howling. He says, I want to do the right thing and pay for the abortion. Oh, when he said that, I was like, oh, if I were her, I'd be so mad right now.
He's like, I'll come with you. But he says it in such a genuine, sweet way. It's like, yeah,
but
girl.
Then she's like, I don't know. And then we find out she's Catholic and that's not an option.
Oh, God.
So then we cut to a scene where David Keith proposes to her and she says yes. And then he's like, oh, this is great. I just resigned. And she's like, what? Yeah, I resigned. I never wanted to be a Navy man. And she's like, fool, the only reason I wanted to marry you is because I wanted to marry a pilot. So no, I'm not doing this.
He's like, I'm going to take you to live in Oklahoma. We'll have to live with my parents because we're going to be poor for a while.
But we're going to be poor, but I can get my job back at JCPenney. And she's like, boy, bye. So then David Keith is like distraught and he goes and rents a hotel. In a funny scene where the front desk man, David Keith, shows him the wedding ring. And he's like, I want to show you something you've probably never seen, or something really cool, he says. And David Keith puts that big ass engagement ring in his mouth and drinks it, mm-hmm. like swallows it.
With a swig of some kind of brown liquor.
And that front desk man looked at him like,
he rolled his eyes.
If I cared any less, yeah. I'd be on the ground right now. So then David Keith goes to his room. And I mean, you could see it coming from a mile away, yes. But he ends up killing himself. He hangs himself from the shower, mm-hmm. and Richard Gere has to find him. And then they go confront Lynette and she's mad. And then now Richard Gere is upset. It also felt very poetic justice to me about when Tupac's cousin gets killed. And then now he tells Janet, like, if I wouldn't have been wasting my time fucking around with your tramp ass.
That's right. Like,
I mean,
that's funny because we watched the trailer for the movie The Brothers last night. And there's I forget who it is having a conversation with Gabrielle Union. And they have almost the exact same conversation that Richard Gere and Deborah Winger have in this about what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then that's happening. Then we get the final, like, obstacle course run before they can graduate. And we've been told throughout that for the female character Cigar, she has to be able to climb this wall in the obstacle course. And so of course we get that scene where she can't do it, and then Richard Gere stops and basically gives her like this pep talk to get her over the I thought that was so corny,
because it was,
yeah. It was so corny, yeah.
Well, they all stop because even Harold Sylvester is like, come on, Cigar.
But I was waiting for the moment when, like, this movie just never gave me that uplifting, because I felt like the basic training portion of it should have felt like Rocky, where, like, they, you know, they make it, but it never felt like that, because when they finally all cross the line, Louis Gossett Jr. is just standing there with his clipboard, like, mm-hmm. he doesn't even have an expression on his face.
The basic training felt, every moment we had with it felt like, oh, y'all still doing that?
So then after that, this is before David Keith kills himself, but David Keith drops out and he's walking with Louis Gossett Jr. and Richard Gere chases them down and starts screaming at Louis Gossett Jr., telling him that David Keith was the best student. And like, what? How was he?
Yeah, I don't.
In fact, we were told you were the best student. And then.
But there was cheating in aerodynamics.
But then David Keith tells Richard Gere, no, Louis Gossett Jr. didn't kick me out. I resigned. And that made me think, this is why I don't intervene in other people's business. Because I think in one, I forget, there was a recent podcast or video where I said, like, I wouldn't jump in watching two people get into a fight. And so, there were a couple comments related to that. Like, damn, you wouldn't help? No, because
it depends.
Because you stick your neck out for people and then they do shit like this. Like, oh, no. I wanted this. Now I look stupid.
Well, I was thinking of the River Phoenix character in Stand By Me who gets stabbed to death because he gets in the middle of a knife fight. I wouldn't be getting in the middle of that fight.
No, but even like you see two couples fighting, like domestic violence, and it's like, I'm not about to jump in because this man slapped you, because come to find out this is the 83rd time he slapped your ass in public.
Sure,
like,
but I mean,
I'm not going to be the one.
I would call the cops. I mean, I'm not going to be a neighbor like the Kitty Genovese people.
No, I have called the cops. I called the cops while you were gone the last time. In Berlin, because I was outside and there was a man screaming at this lady, like, but I walked away. Like, I walked away from the direction
you did the Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah. Yeah, walk away. But yeah, no, I thought Richard looked a plum fool screaming about David Keith's honor. And he's like, oh no, I didn't even want to be here.
But it's also David Keith, it had nothing to do with Foley.
No.
Foley didn't ruin this man's little life, that he should be beaten on Lynette.
Yeah, you need to go.
You need to go manhandle Lynette.
Lynette is the reason David Keith felt like lost course. I have to just reiterate how, like, when David Keith tells Lynette that they can move back to Oklahoma and he can get his job back at JCPenney,
she looks. She couldn't say ew loud enough with those eyes. And she's like, I don't want an Okie from Muskogee.
I thought a better title for this movie, because I forget where this came from, but someone says, I want out.
I think it's David Keith.
Is it? And I thought that would have been a good title because...
No, Richard Gere screams at a Deborah Winger.
That's right. I think that would have been a better title because that's essentially what everyone's trying to do. Richard Gere wants out of the life that he had. Those women want out of this small town and that print factory. All these cadets or whatever trainees want out of this basic training. Because what does an officer and a gentleman mean to you? Who's the gentleman?
I think that's what he becomes in the end.
You think he becomes a gentleman?
No,
I don't.
But I don't. I think that's what the end goal is after this training.
So after David Keith dies, Richard Gere goes to confront Louis Gossett Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, I heard about whatever his name is, Sid, or I forget.
Do you mean David Keith's character?
Yeah, what's his character name?
Sid.
Is it? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. And Richard Gere challenges Louis Gossett Jr. to a fight. He calls him a motherfucker in front of all his trainees.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into the shed and have a fight.
Yeah.
That was crazy. That was laughable.
That was laughable because then we get the graduation scene after that. And then the Taylor Hackford is keeping us away from seeing if Richard Gere's actually there. And then when he is, it's like, oh, damn.
Right. So it's. You know, I really do think there may be something to this whole magical Negro thing, because they disrespected Louis Gossett Jr. They made a joke out of him. He had no real power. And then all the shit he was saying, which we find out in the end, because we circle back to Louis Gossett Jr. getting a new set of trainees.
Mm-hmm.
And he is saying the same shit to all of them that he told Richard Gere and his group.
And it's right after the graduation ceremony. They are farming these men and women in there.
But like, it just felt so like, because he tells them half of you are going to drop out. And I'm sure that's a way to scare them into taking it seriously.
Sure.
But I feel like, yeah, the Foley character, Louis Gossett Jr., is kind of a joke in this movie. And he only serves the purpose of being like a conduit to the main character, Richard Gere.
Mm-hmm.
A conduit for what I don't know. Because I don't believe that Richard Gere would make a good pilot, because he's not very smart. He doesn't understand aerodynamics and physics. How are you going to be a pilot? Lastly, that scene where Richard Gere goes to get Paula from the print factory and everyone's watching them walk out, and Lynette, who Deborah Winger had a falling out with.
Yeah.
Paula had a falling out with Lynette. When Lynette sees Paula leave with Richard Gere, she goes, way to go, Paula.
I know. You dumb.
Ugh. Just like, so this is this only woman's like hope, is to have this like fucking douchebag of a man.
Her ticket to ride. Her? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really hated the messaging of this story.
I know
that it's realistic and that many women, you know, like for the time, and it's not so out of bounds, but it was so unsatisfying.
It was.
I did not want her with him. I don't think he'll make a good pilot.
Or
I felt
partner.
Bad for David Keith. Louis Gossett Jr., his character looked like a joke.
Lynette's trash.
Lynette's a real one, though, because she had a plan.
She did. She was not Gone with the Wind fabulous. Louis Gossett Jr. won over Charles Durning for the best little whorehouse in Texas, which I have seen. John Lithgow.
Is that with Dolly Parton?
Yep, and Burt Reynolds.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yep. John Lithgow for The World According to Garp, which I think should have... If you haven't seen that, and specifically his performance... World According to Garp is a wild ride. James Mason for The Verdict, which is a good film. And Robert Preston, his name I was forgetting, for Victor Victoria. Deborah Winger was nominated for Best Actress.
In this movie?
In this movie. Can you believe that? You want to know who she is up against?
Wait, Deborah Winger, not best supporting.
Best actress.
Wow. I mean, she wasn't bad in this movie, but I don't think she had anything to do.
No.
Okay, who was she up against?
Sissy Spacek for Missing.
Okay.
Jessica Lange for Frances, which I still really want you to watch someday.
Okay.
Julie Andrews for Victor Victoria.
Okay.
And this was infamously that year Jessica Lange was double nominated because she lost to Meryl Streep for Sophie's Choice.
Well, I haven't seen any of those movies. Who do you think should have won?
Meryl or Jessica.
And who won?
Meryl. But I mean, all of those roles, Missing, Frances, Victor Victoria, and Sophie's Choice, those are at a way higher level than whatever's going on to me in Officer and Gentleman. And also, this is the year, 1982, where Deborah Winger also starred in Cannery Row, the Steinbeck adaptation. And that was a infamous film because the, I forget if it's the director, the producers hired Raquel Welch to use her name for funding, and then they fired her. And Raquel Welch had to sue because they really wanted Deborah Winger. I think it's also worth noting that the role of Paula was first offered to Sigourney Weaver.
For this role? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For the Paula role. Yeah.
I'm glad she was not in this. She did The Year of Living Dangerously that year instead with Peter Weir.
Yeah, I saw that. And then Angelica Houston, who I don't think, well, I might, I don't know. I think this,
well,
casting is interesting.
Angelica Houston also always looked very Italian to me, and there's a lot of Polish jokes about this character. There were a couple other notable women that were. I just think that because they have Deborah Winger using bad grammar in this, and it's like I don't think Sigourney seemed too intelligent for this role.
Well, she wouldn't have matched Richard Gere. She's too tall, and like it just.
Well, that was always plaguing her then, yeah.
I think they needed a woman who was a little more rough around the edges, but still very beautiful, and someone who you would believe thinks that she has no other option.
Uh-huh.
And I just didn't see that with Paula. Paula seemed to have more integrity than Lynette, and it just seemed like she... And then she saw... Because we're told that Paula's mother, who's supposed to be 39 years old, has worked in the factory since she was 17, mm-hmm. and that she doesn't want her life.
Mm-hmm.
Then what the movie is telling us is that a better life for her would be attached to this man.
Right. Like, in truth, I think Grace Zabriskie was probably 41 or 42 there. So close.
I'm not saying she doesn't look her age, I guess, but I'm just more saying that it's just kind of disappointing that this young lady who had all these examples of probably what not to do just ends up doing a different version of that. When what I wanted to have happen was her realize that the best thing for her to do is forge her own path outside of this place without this man who, from my perspective, hadn't proven himself to be a worthy companion
in any way beyond their sex scene, which seemed to blow her mind.
Right. Which was very like, I don't.
What did you say? You're like, why are they acting like dogs that can't detach?
Yeah, the sex scene was not very sexy. Whatever. What would you give an Officer and a Gentleman?
2.5.
I thought it was okay. I would give it 2.5 out of 5.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I think we have some fun things this week coming up, though.
Do we?
Monkey Man, the Dev Patel film that he directed, and The First Omen, which I'm actually kind of looking forward to.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're looking forward to something.
And you will be seeing The Beast this week, my favorite film from last year.
Well, if we make it that far, yes.
We will. We shall. We shall overcome.
All done?
Mm-hmm.
Bye.